Trump administration officials are defending the decision to kill Iranian General Qasem Soleimani.
Look, you're not a U.S. diplomat. I am a U.S. diplomat. What you're asking me is, why didn't we look the other way when U.S. diplomats were about to be killed?
European diplomats have this request of the U.S.
to cut out further provocative statements and still more provocative actions.
Also, grab the wool. Knitters across the globe are rallying around a special project.
My needles are hot. They're ready.
We'll explain. Plus, the planet runs on plastic that is clogging our oceans. So scientists are cooking up a completely new plastic.
What we've created is a plastic that can be deconstructed into its molecular building blocks.
I'm Marco Werman. Those stories and more today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. In Iran today, at least 50 people were killed and more than 200 injured in a stampede at the funeral procession for Qasem Soleimani. The Iranian military commander was killed in an American airstrike last Friday in Baghdad. During 2 days of public mourning across Iran, millions of Iranians came out in a show of national unity. This afternoon, President Trump called Soleimani a monster.
And he's no longer a monster. He's dead. And that's a good thing for a lot of countries. And he was planning a very big attack and a very bad attack.
Trump said a lot of lives were saved by killing Soleimani. Trump's top administration officials were out in front of the cameras all day defending him. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo called Trump's order to kill Soleimani the right decision. But America's allies in Europe say both sides, the U.S. and Iran, need to do their parts to ease tensions. Here's The World's Orla Barry in London.
The British Prime Minister was on vacation in the Caribbean when the news broke last Friday that the US had killed Iran's top military commander. Boris Johnson's initial statement, when it came, was cautious. He said he would not be lamenting the death of Qasem Soleimani, but he also urged restraint on all sides. It was left to the British Foreign Secretary Dominic Raab to do the talking. Raab said that escalating conflict with Iran is, quote, in none of our interests.
Frankly, it's the decision that the Americans have taken, but we understand why they did it. Let's be clear about this. They have the right to exercise self-defence. And General Soleimani was the head of the commander of the Quds force. So we understand the position and the action they've taken.
It took more than 48 hours for European Union leaders in France, Germany and the UK to issue a joint statement on the killing of the Iranian general. This perhaps was an indication that not all sides were in total agreement. That statement also appealed to both sides, the US and Iran, to step back from the brink of war. EU spokesman Peter Stano encouraged all parties to de-escalate.
Our strength, I think, is in the ability as the EU to talk to the partners and put the arguments why it is in everyone's interest to de-escalate the situation.
On Sunday, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo was asked about the response from America's most important allies. And here's some of what he had to say on Fox News.
Frankly, the Europeans haven't been as helpful as I wish that they could be. The Brits, the French, the Germans all need to understand that what we did, what the Americans did, saved lives in Europe as well.
But the Europeans never really signed on to the Trump administration's hardline approach towards Iran. They've worked to keep the Iran nuclear deal in place since the US walked away from it in 2018. And now Iran says it will no longer abide by the deal's limits on uranium enrichment. That's a real blow to the European Union.
I think the problems for the EU member states is they don't have anything else available and they don't really have any other options.
Richard Whitman is Associate Fellow at Chatham House, a think tank in London. He says the Europeans are still struggling to save the Iran nuclear deal.
They want to preserve a dialogue. Really, it's a bit of desperation in hanging on to that deal, even though it's pretty threadbare now.
Foreign ministers from France, Germany and the UK met in Brussels today. Ministers from all 28 EU states will hold an emergency meeting this Friday, but the member states come to the table with different agendas. Germany, for example, is already planning on pulling some of its troops out of Iraq. Britain, on the other hand, is keeping about 400 soldiers there, at least for now. But the issue that's front of mind for Boris Johnson has to be Britain's plan to finally leave the European Union in just 3 weeks' time. Lewis Lukens was the deputy chief of mission at the US Embassy in London from 2016 until 2019. He says the Prime Minister is walking a diplomatic tightrope.
Between remaining closely aligned with his European partners and allies, but at the same time, the Prime Minister cannot be seen as turning his back on President Trump because he's very focused on trying to lay the groundwork for a US-UK free trade agreement in the coming few years.
Johnson might also be mindful of recent history, when past British prime ministers aligned themselves with the US for the purposes of taking military action in the Middle East. Things have not always worked out so well. Here's Richard Whitman again.
Parliamentarians now very loath to see the UK involved in major overseas military adventures. And I think even with his significant parliamentary majority, Boris Johnson's going to face a parliament which I think would be very difficult to persuade that this is something that the UK should be deeply involved in.
A word of caution came from the former British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw. He served during the US-led invasion of Iraq in 2003, and he had this message for President Trump.
I tell him to take a very, very deep breath and to cut out further provocative statements and still more provocative actions. It's very, very dangerous.
Boris Johnson got on the phone today with Iraq's Prime Minister to talk about working together to find a way forward. A spokesman said Johnson also told the Iraqi leader that the UK is committed to Iraq's stability and to the fight against ISIS. For The World, I'm Orla Barry in London.
For another view, we reached out to one of President Trump's top diplomats in Europe. He told us, as far as he's concerned, Europe is totally on board with U.S. policy toward Iran.
We're very pleased with the reaction from the Germans and from the larger European-wide community. I think there's a total agreement that Iran is responsible for the escalation.
That's Richard Grenell, the U.S. ambassador to Germany.
What we've seen is a number of statements from Europeans, certainly here in Germany I'm familiar with, whether it's the defense secretary, party leaders, government spokespeople. We've just seen across the board commitment that the escalation is the responsibility of the Iranians, and that all of these issues, including the rise in terrorism, is to be blamed on the Iranian regime.
We have heard a lot of criticism from Europe, though, about what seems to be a lack of foresight in the White House about how killing Soleimani might lead to really bad consequences.
That's your job, right, to focus on the negative. But I would urge you to also focus on the positive. I have a list of positive comments that I haven't heard from radio interviews or news programs. You know, I see a lot of news outlets quoting the Iranian regime leaders, but the public in Iran, the everyday people, are not allowed to go on Instagram or Twitter and voice their free opinions.
Although this time something seems to have shifted in Iran. I mean, these hundreds of thousands of people, possibly millions, are out in the streets. And I know that sometimes they are paid to go out, but there's a huge section of these protesters who are very upset that he was killed, the general.
Yeah, I think I would caution you very much to know if you are in touch with people who will send messages like they have sent to the embassy and to me personally. They are saying that they're not only forced to paint their doors black and look like they are weeping, but they're forced to go out. This is a society that if you don't go out, then your family suffers.
Right. All I'm saying is that in this particular instance, it seems that there are many Iranians, hundreds of thousands of Iranians, who've gone out on the streets willingly. It doesn't necessarily mean they support the regime. Let me ask you this, Ambassador. We know that
I need to push back on that because I don't buy that. I don't believe that just because you see someone in the street in Iran, that person is freely there weeping at the prospect of Soleimani being killed. I think that many people inside of Iran know exactly what's happening, and yet they are very afraid.
Well, I'm not basing that just on what I'm seeing. We've been speaking with people in Iran, and that's what I'm also hearing. Anyway, look, I don't want to downplay General Soleimani's crimes. We know he was responsible for hundreds of American deaths, and it is possible he was planning an imminent attack on U.S. forces. We haven't seen the evidence yet. But can you help us understand how taking Soleimani out at this moment in time fits into America's strategy in the Mideast?
Look, you're not a U.S. diplomat. I am a U.S. diplomat. I work at the State Department. What you're asking me is, why didn't we look the other way when U.S. diplomats were about to be killed? That's what you're asking me. And I think that it's a very
I'm actually asking why now, because we haven't seen the evidence, so I don't know what the evidence is.
Yeah, you're,
why
you're
now?
A reporter. You're not going to see the intelligence evidence. And to assume that somehow that you are going to see the intelligence evidence, I think, is contrary to the way that the government works. So the simple fact is that this was a moment where the president of the United States felt very strongly that we could not look the other way. We had 11 attacks in the last weeks. We've also had our embassy, where U.S. diplomats work, burned and bombed. So I'm not sure what the question is in terms of, should we look the other way when our U.S. embassies overseas are burned and bombed? We've been through that before in Libya.
What I'm asking is, if you're looking at
a very good idea to look the other way.
If you pull out to 35,000 feet and you look at the goal of preventing Iran from getting a nuclear weapon, what I'm asking is, why now taking out Soleimani? How does that help achieve that goal?
Well, I'm just telling you that your 35,000 feet question means that you ignore U.S. diplomats about to be killed. The assumption in that question is somehow that the Iranians get to act like terrorists, and we're just supposed to accept that because the Iranian regime does that. And I think that
I'm actually asking to see the evidence that there was an imminent attack.
Is that he doesn't want to allow diplomats, allow U.S. personnel to be killed like this. He does not want our embassies to be attacked. And I'm thankful that we have a president that is willing to make those tough decisions.
Ambassador, you were nominated to your position by President Trump. He campaigned on ending what he calls America's endless wars. Don't you think we're now at risk of entering another one?
No, I don't, because President Trump has made very clear from the very beginning that he wants to bring our troops home, that he doesn't want to start wars, and that his actions recently to take out Soleimani is really about stopping these endless wars that we are fighting in the Middle East, that defeating terrorism is really the goal.
Richard Grenell, the U.S. ambassador to Germany, speaking with us from Berlin. Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Big legal news from England. A judge there has ruled that ethical veganism is a philosophical belief. No bones about it. That means it must be protected from discrimination in the workplace, just like religious beliefs. The case was brought by Jordi Casamitjana. He claims he was fired for his commitment to veganism. Casamitjana spoke outside the courtroom after the decision came down.
I'm extremely happy. I obviously wanted this verdict. I didn't expect to have it so soon.
When we say ethical veganism, we're not talking about people who get a veggie burger for lunch once in a while. Ethical vegans try to avoid any form of animal exploitation. No wool or leather clothes, for example. It's a whole way of life. That is a crucial distinction, says lawyer Anthony Korn. He specializes in employment and discrimination law.
In an earlier case, a vegan failed to show that she had a philosophical belief. The tribunal concluded that she just held an opinion.
According to the court's opinion, is just that. But the specific category of religion or belief is protected by UK law. Looking ahead, Korn believes this new ruling could lead to discrimination suits if vegan employees don't feel accommodated at work.
If they're laughed at, teased, or made to feel unwelcome in the workplace, that could give rise to a claim. Going out for your Christmas meal and not being offered a vegan option might give rise to a complaint of discrimination.
While vegans are celebrating, some critics wonder if this could open a Pandora's box and that others might seek protection for their own beliefs. A British judge already ruled in 2009 that a strongly held belief in climate change was protected by workplace discrimination laws. But Casamitjana says the ruling makes sense to him.
Veganism is a philosophical belief. And when you look at my life and anybody else's life that is an ethical vegan, you will see it.
This is not over. Casamitjana's former employer maintains he was fired for misconduct, not for being vegan. A judge has yet to rule on whether he lost his job unfairly. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. This is The World. Early this morning, Puerto Rico was hit with a 6.4 magnitude earthquake centered just off the main island. It was the biggest in a string of tremors that have rattled Puerto Rico for the past 10 days. It pushed the island into a state of emergency. One of the areas that was hardest hit is the southern city of Ponce. Maria Melendez is the mayor of Ponce.
Everybody was outside the street there were no lights in Puerto Rico, no electricity in Puerto Rico, no water in Puerto Rico at the same time by the 4:30 in the morning. But I live near my Central Office of Emergency Services. I live about 3 minutes walking. So my escort immediately came, moved me to the emergency office, and we began to get news for all the areas that were affected.
So as mayor of Ponce, you were kind of organizing and managing the relief services. So this was a magnitude 6.6 earthquake, already on top of a large quake the day before. What sort of damage have you seen?
There were bridges destroyed. There were houses that were collapsed and destroyed at the same time. There are buildings that are more than six floors that they are broken. And at the same time, people were afraid and people were outside in the street, because people didn't want to stay in the condominiums, not even on their houses, because the earthquake was continuing. Not only the 6.6, but they 15 minutes later, another one. And we have since last night more than 12 earthquakes, but much lesser degree, 1.3, 2.2.
But the point you're making is that the tremors and the aftershocks are continuing today.
They are continuing today, more than six. In the south, that Ponce is in the south, is the most affected area. Another city most affected is Guayanilla. These cities are 15 to 20 minutes from Ponce.
So, Madam Mayor, what about injuries and fatalities?
In Ponce, 9 persons were taken to the hospital because they felt they broke some of their knees, but they are already taken care of in the hospitals. But we have a loss. We have a loss. It's a wall that at the same time that fall, and this wall was there was a man that was sleeping of 73 years old, and he died.
Oh,
and he died. That's the only loss that we have up to now. I don't know exactly if there are injuries or people that die in Guayanilla, Yauco, or Guanica, because the communications, all the mayors are out of their emergency center taking care of the buildings that are collapsed. At the same time, the houses are destroyed and taking out the people of the broken houses.
I mean, that is sad, but we hope there are no other fatalities. Mayor Melendez, can you tell us a little bit about Ponce? What is the community like?
Well, Ponce is the second largest city in territorial extension. Ponce is a colonial city, but at the same time, it's a mother city. It's like San Juan. You have more than 5 hospitals. At the same time, it has a school of medicine. It has, at the same time, architectural school, law school. It is a big center in all of the south area. We have about 150,000 people living in Ponce. A big mall and many shopping centers. At the same time, there are a big auditorium. Our auditorium for basketball, we cannot use it because it's broken in the roof.
And it's broken in the roof because of the earthquake?
Yes, because of the earthquake. So we are trying to use the areas that are in the baseball park to be using as an emergency center and giving help to the people. The governor of Puerto Rico, she has asked the National Guard to help all the cities in the south. So people are working together.
Maria Melendez is mayor of Ponce, Puerto Rico. Thank you very much. Stay safe.
No, anything we can help you. And I want you to thank you too, so the people of Maylin can understand what is happening in Puerto Rico. We have suffered 2 years after Maria. We have not yet recovered from Maria. And we only are praying that God will protect us. And at the same time, any help that the federal government will give us, it will be important that the President of the United States please sign the emergency resolution that the governor of Puerto Rico, Wanda Garcetti, has sent him to him. Thank you very much.
The mere existence of Amazons, fierce women fighters, has been debated for decades. The stuff of legend or reality? Now a growing body of archaeological evidence shows the women did exist, and they were serious warriors. Archaeologists found remains last month of 4 female warriors buried together in a tomb. According to researchers at the Russian Academy of Sciences, the women were part of the Scythians, a nomadic tribe that lived in Siberia. Adrian Mayer is the author of The Amazons, Lives and Legends of Warrior Women Across the Ancient World. I'm just curious how you reacted when you heard about this tomb. Were you surprised?
I was not surprised, but I was absolutely delighted. This particular discovery is unique because it contains four women with that age range, from older woman of high status down to a 12 or 13-year-old young girl, all fighting together as companions in warfare, all trained in the same way and buried with the same honors as male warriors. It just shows overwhelming proof that there really were flesh and blood women living the lives of mythical Amazons in antiquity.
So we should point out that you were not part of this excavation, but you have studied the lives of warrior women. So talk about that age range. Why is that significant? What does it tell us about the lives these women lived?
Scythian nomads lived in a harsh landscape. Their lives were centered on horseback riding and archery. And that's a great equalizer for men and women. So boys and girls were trained together at the same age. Even as toddlers, they began to ride horses and learned how to shoot bows and arrows. That was their culture. So it made sense for everyone to be trained to defend the tribe and to hunt. This new discovery proves that women of childbearing age also served as warriors, as well as the very youngest were trained in the arts of warfare.
Adrian, I'm curious, help us understand how could these women and young women have died and been buried all at the same time?
The archaeologists said that they couldn't find any battle wounds, but that doesn't mean that they weren't killed in battle. I would imagine that they were buried together because they had participated in a raid against some other hostile tribe and had all died in that skirmish and so were buried together with their weapons.
The researchers say the average life expectancy of a Scythian woman at the time was between 30 to 35 years old, but one of the women in the tomb was between 45 and 50. So could the life expectancy analysis be off, or did this woman just outlive her counterparts?
I think it's entirely possible that they had a longer age range than what has been proposed. She must have been very highly respected, perhaps a leader. The fact that she was wearing a golden headpiece and was buried with so many arrows suggests that she was probably the leader of a war band.
Were these women related to each other? Like, how were they connected?
We're not sure how they were connected. The idea is that they were companions in warfare and died together and were buried together.
Adrian Mayer, the author of The Amazons, Lives and Legends of Warrior Women Across the Ancient World. Adrian, thanks very much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're listening to The World. National security decisions often have life and death consequences, and critics say right now the decision-making process at the White House is not working.
You have to have a process that brings multiple perspectives to bear, including dissent, in order to get good decisions. When that process breaks down, you're going to get some bad decisions.
That's coming up here on The World. I'm Marco Werman. You're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, WGBH Boston, and PRX. The U.S. decision to assassinate Iran's number two last week is troubling for many foreign policy professionals. President Trump ordered the U.S. military to kill Iranian General Qasem Soleimani. Life and death decisions are not normally made quickly in Washington. The U.S. government has well-established processes to make sure that costs and benefits, risks and opportunities are carefully weighed. Michelle Flournoy knows these systems through a lifetime of experience in national security. She was Undersecretary of Defense for Policy under Barack Obama and now runs the strategic consultancy West Exec Advisors.
Normally, the question of how to respond to a series of Iranian provocations, ultimately the attack by an Iranian-backed proxy that killed a contractor, you'd have a discussion about how to respond. And several options would be put on the table, and those would be vetted and discussed interagency across the National Security Council at multiple levels, usually starting with deputy secretaries, then moving to principals, and eventually moving to the president. But in this administration, for a very long time now, that normal process has been non-existent. The deputies rarely meet, the principals rarely meet. Very serious decisions are brought to the president without a whole lot of vetting and exploration of second and third order consequences. And so they clearly presented a set of tactical options to him, either the strategic consequences weren't explored and explained, or he didn't care to listen to that. He made a pretty hasty decision, and now we're living with the consequences of that.
Well, the administration is defending itself. Just this morning, Secretary of State Mike Pompeo spoke to reporters and said the system is working well. Here he is.
Anytime a president makes a decision of this magnitude, there are multiple pieces of information that come before us. We presented that to him in all its broad detail. We gave him all the best information that came not only from the intelligence community, but for those of us who have teams in the field. We evaluated the relevant risks and the opportunity that we thought might present itself at some point, and we could see clearly.
Michelle Flournoy, I mean, what you essentially described a moment ago is what happened with this decision. Trump was presented with a range of options. He chose the most extreme option that I think a lot of his advisors did not really expect him to take. So when you look at that and you look at the system, what is working and what is not?
Well, first of all, if the majority of the advisors believe that it's a bad option or not the best option, I question why was it put before the president of the United States. Normally, a good process eliminates bad options. On the other hand, if the option survives scrutiny, it's incumbent on the principals who are there with the president to make sure he fully understands all of the second and third order consequences, all of the risks. It's hard for me to believe that it was explained to President Trump that this would put every embassy and every U.S. military base in the Middle East at higher levels of risk from Iran or Iranian proxies, that it would basically undermine our campaign against ISIS by violating Iraqi sovereignty in a way that would force the Iraqis to almost have to come to some decision to push us out or to restrict our movements, and that it would also lift the lid on the Pandora's box of assassination. I mean, as horrible as Soleimani was and as, you know, legitimate he was as a target, he was also the second most powerful person in Iran and an Iranian official. So now any U.S. official who's traveling in the region, you know, Iran will say, hey, they're fair game. You assassinated our guy. Why can't we assassinate yours? So I can't believe that Trump would have chosen the option had that all been explained to him. If he did choose that option fully informed of those consequences, then this is even more dangerous a situation than we thought.
So Trump supporters who, like their disruptor in chief, may ask why these systems and cogent policies matter. So let me put it to you. Why do they matter?
They matter because if you want the decisions that put Americans in harm's way and put blood and treasure on the line like no other, if you want those decisions to be fully and well-informed, you have to have a process that brings multiple perspectives to bear, including dissent, in order to get good decisions. When that process breaks down, you're going to get some bad decisions.
Michelle Flournoy, former Undersecretary of Defense, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Prepare for cyber attacks from Iran, so says the U.S. government, as it anticipates retaliation over the killing of Qasem Soleimani. Yesterday, the U.S. Department of Homeland Security issued guidelines on how U.S. companies and other potential targets can prepare for cyber attacks from Iran. The World's Lydia Manalidou has been following this and is with me in the studio. So DHS is warning about a range of attacks here. What kind of things are they envisioning?
Marco, there's a big range of possible tactics here that we've seen Iran use against the U.S., tactics that are meant to intimidate and disrupt. You might remember back in 2012, the Obama administration imposed really tough sanctions on Iran's oil industry. Iran responded by hitting major U.S. banks with what are called denial of service attacks. And this made it hard for people to log into their accounts, access their money, systems were crashing. Then a couple years later, Iran targeted an American casino company using a so-called wiper attack.
And what is a wiper attack?
This is actually one of Iran's main tactics. They get into a computer or network and wipe out the data completely. So I talked to half a dozen cybersecurity experts, and they told me that what makes these types of attacks particularly potent is that they let Iran flex its cyber muscles to show that it can cause disruptions and have a direct impact on Americans' lives. But experts I spoke with are also really concerned about cyber-enabled espionage. Here's John Holtquist with the cybersecurity company FireEye.
we're going to see an uptick of cyber espionage from Iranian actors who are tasked with gathering intelligence on what's going to happen next. So they're going to want to know what the U.S. side is thinking. They're going to want to know what our allies are thinking. They're going to know what the military is doing to prepare.
And so, Lydia, how do Iranians actually do this?
You know, Iranians are probably not going to go after entire government agencies or private companies, but individual people working for them. Because, as you know, it's much easier to manipulate an individual to give you access to a larger system. And historically, the way Iranians have conducted cyber espionage is through spear phishing.
Right. Spear phishing, that's sending someone an email with a link that has a bug in it and getting them somehow to click on it and then getting access to the whole system. Is that it?
Exactly. And this is a tactic that the Iranians use a lot. And this is where experts say every single one of us could take an action that would make a difference. So being careful about what we click on, using two-factor authentication, backing up our systems, it's all really important.
Lydia, are there also concerns about Iran targeting like critical infrastructure, power grids and water treatment systems or communications here in the U.S. and causing physical damage, maybe even shutting off a whole electrical grid?
Yeah, so I spoke about this with Joe Slowick. He used to be part of the computer security incident response team at the U.S. Department of Energy. He's now a threat hunter with the cybersecurity company Dragos, which focuses on industrial control systems. And I asked him whether he expects Iran to go after, you know, the energy sector, transportation systems, hospitals, and other critical infrastructure.
We certainly know that Iran has been interested in this space for some time, as they have the unfortunate distinction of being the first victim of a industrial control focused cyber event, Stuxnet.
Stuxnet, of course, was that sophisticated malware that the U.S. and Israel were suspected of planting at a uranium enrichment facility in Iran. That was 2010. It really set back Iran's nuclear efforts.
It did. And Stuxnet was also a wake-up call for Iran that it needed to invest in its cyber capabilities. And since then, we've seen Iran go after critical infrastructure, not really in the U.S., but in the Gulf region. In 2012, for example, Iranian hackers targeted Saudi Aramco, the world's largest oil producer based in Saudi Arabia. Mm. They were able to gain access to administrative computers and used a wiper attack to wipe data off some 30,000 machines.
Wow.
But there's no indication that they were able to get into the industrial control systems that, you know, affect the physical oil production process.
If you have every Windows machine in your environment suddenly wiped and inaccessible, that is a bad thing, no matter how you look at it. At the same time, nothing that we've seen approaches the level of using a cyber means to influence a physical process.
So the idea of turning off electrical power or closing water pumps, the Iranians don't seem to be quite there yet.
Right. And even if they were, it's not clear that they would want to even take a drastic move like that.
So finally, Lydia, how do Iran's cyber capabilities compare to other countries that might have tried stuff in the past, or even the United States?
The experts I spoke with told me that Iran doesn't have the cyber capabilities of, say, Russia, China, or the U.S., but the U.S. government does see it as a threat. It's been years since we saw a major Iran-linked cyber attack against the U.S. That's because when the nuclear deal was signed in 2015, Iran kind of eased off on cyber attacks against the U.S., but they've been practicing on their neighbors in the Gulf, using cyber attacks to destabilize and intimidate regional adversaries. So a provocation of the magnitude that we saw with the killing of Soleimani last week, experts suggested to me that it might mean that we see Iran take some steps in the cyberspace that we've never seen before.
The world's Lydia Emanuelidou. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Marco.
Here's a discouraging statistic, considering how much effort many of us put into sorting our garbage and getting recyclables where they need to go. Worldwide, less than 10% of the plastic we use gets recycled. Most ends up in landfills and often makes its way out to sea, clogging up our oceans. It's a major problem, and yet it's hard to see how it ends. Global demand for plastic is projected to triple by mid-century. But what if there was a better plastic? The world's Jason Margolis has that story.
Here's the problem with plastic. It's super useful. Lightweight and strong, smooth and flexible. Back when Dustin Hoffman's character in The Graduate was entering the workforce a half century ago, the career advice was simple.
Just one word.
Yes, sir.
Are you listening?
Yes, I am.
Plastics.
But the guy giving advice probably wasn't thinking of all the junk we'd be stuck with two generations later. Toys, straws, and tiny ketchup pouches, things that make life more convenient, can take hundreds of years to degrade. Here's the other problem. Plastic isn't just plastic. There are hundreds of different kinds. Think of a flexible plastic baggie versus a water bottle versus rigid plastic for your computer keyboard. Most of us just toss it all in the blue recycling bin and say, should be okay.
The industry has started calling that wish cycling.
Susan Collins is the president of the Container Recycling Institute.
Especially with curbside recycling that uses the single stream process where we put all of our recyclables in one bin. The expression we use a lot is that you can't unscramble an egg.
Recycling gets contaminated and then it's trash, bound for the landfill. Still, even if you deliver a pristine batch of plastic bottles to the recycler, there's another hurdle, explains Sue Selke, director of the Center for Packaging, Innovation, and Sustainability at Michigan State University.
Plastics are inherently susceptible to some decrease in their properties when they're recycled.
That leads to this overabundance of plastics in our waste streams.
Brett Helms shows me around his lab in the hills of Berkeley, California.
So these are versions of plastics that are stretchy and elastomeric.
His team at the Lawrence Berkeley National Lab is designing a new type of plastic, one you can use over and over and over and over.
What we've created is a plastic that can be deconstructed into its molecular building blocks.
So a new phone case could later be rebuilt into a watch band or part of a new shoe, for example.
And the way that that becomes possible is by designing plastics to degrade with essentially no difference in quality or performance from the virgin resin.
Most plastics are not like Legos. Once the parts, or molecules in this case, are snapped together, they can't easily be taken apart.
But for recycling, you need to go in the reverse direction. So you need to take these big, long chains that may have other things in them, and you have to be able to efficiently deconstruct them at the molecular level.
Acid allows this new plastic to be depolymerized. If that makes sense to you, awesome. If not, here are puppets Busta and Pong from the UK's National Recycling Campaign to explain.
What you throw away depends on you, but recycling means it will come back as something new.
So what you throw away depends on you, but recycling means it will come back as something new.
Okay, maybe rethinking the chemistry of plastic isn't that simple. Still, Helms hopes his new plastic encourages other innovators to rethink how plastic is designed. The British newspaper The Independent asked if this could be the holy grail of plastic.
If you think it's the holy grail, you're definitely getting prematurely excited.
Sue Selke at Michigan State wants to learn more about this new plastic being cooked up in the labs of Berkeley. Some commercially available plastics can already be broken down to the molecular level. But the problem with that, it's not cheap.
It takes more expense, more energy, usually, to do that kind of recycling than to just do mechanical recycling.
Mechanical recycling is very simply melting down old plastics to make new ones, a cheaper way, but again, you can only do that so many times. But there's more to this plastic debate than just economics. One recent study delivered a sobering statistic. If we fail to rethink how we're using plastics, by mid-century, when measured pound for pound, there will be more plastic in our oceans than fish. For The World, I'm Jason Margolis.
You know how sometimes in the course of your day, you'll see something that is unimpressive, banal even, but for some reason it resonates and just sticks with you. That's what happened to Leia Stern when she saw a child's sweater. Green, with puff sleeves and lace trim. Here's The World's Sarah Birnbaum with the story of that sweater, the child who wore it, and the woman who made it her mission to preserve it.
The first time Leia Stern saw the green sweater was at an exhibit about hidden children of the Holocaust.
I was really taken by the concept of this tiny child having to hide in this sweater.
The sweater was worn by a little girl named Christina Heger, who hid with her family in the sewers beneath Lvov, Poland for 14 months in 1943 and 1944. Christina described what it was like in an interview with the Shoah Foundation.
It was terrible. We were sitting on wet, slimy rocks with worms crawling all over. And no light, and huge red rats.
They had to compete with the rats for food.
My father was standing, you know, on guard at night with a stick to trying to scare them because they won't eat the bread because the bread was supposed to be for us.
Christina couldn't bring much with her into the sewer. But one thing she did bring was the sweater knitted for her by her grandmother, who died in a concentration camp. Christina later donated the sweater to the Holocaust Museum in Washington, D.C. That's where Leah Stern saw it, and she says she just couldn't stop thinking about it.
Why did she take that with her? What did it mean to her? Was there a pattern for knitting it?
Now, most people, when they see something interesting in a museum, they make a mental note or they snap a picture. But Leah became haunted by the sweater and the idea of recreating it.
Leah came to me and said, "You have this green sweater in your collection, and I want to create a pattern based on the sweater." And I said, "Oh, okay."
That's Susie Snyder. She's a curator at the Holocaust Museum.
I called my sister, Adrian, and I said, who is a knitter, teaches knitting, knits everything, is a crazy knitter. And I said, "This woman wants to make a pattern out of this sweater that we have in our collection. That's nuts."
Why did you think it's nuts?
I didn't understand it. And Adrian, my sister, right, said to me, "No, from a knitting perspective, it's not nuts."
So Leah got access to the sweater.
It was almost surreal. I couldn't believe that I was actually standing in front of the sweater, that I was going to actually touch it, that I was going to turn it over, turn it inside out, thinking about what the sweater and the person wearing it had gone through. It was humbling.
Leah counted stitches and took copious notes, and from that, she was able to reverse engineer a pattern. Then she enlisted her friends and relatives to start knitting prototypes. In the end, she had about a dozen sweaters in different shades of green. She didn't know what the original color was because the sweater had faded so much, but there was someone who could tell her.
I took the train over to Long Island to Christina's house.
Christina Heger is now in her 80s, a retired dentist living with her husband on Long Island, New York. Leah brought all the different sweaters with her so Christina could choose the one that was most like the sweater her grandmother had made for her. Christina pointed to the vibrant lime green one.
"It's not what I would have guessed, but it's what she said. This is just the color that it was." And it was much brighter than what the sweater looks like now. And she picked it up and she held it up to her and she said, "Now I have my sweater back."
Leah's pattern is for sale at the Holocaust Museum gift shop and on a popular knitting website called Ravelry, with all the proceeds going to the museum. She's heard from hundreds of knitters who are making the sweater here in the U.S. and also in Norway, Ireland, Israel, the U.K. She's heard from people like Renee Silberman in Ontario, Canada, who can't wait to get started on the project.
"My needles are hot. They're ready."
Amazing. Renee is making the sweater for her 8-year-old granddaughter, Annika, as a way to teach her about the Holocaust.
"It's maybe an easy way for a child to come to understand history. And I think it will show my granddaughter the tremendous endurance that people had even in troubled times."
It took me a long time to understand why so many people were making this sweater. I mean, the sweater looks sweet, but it's dated. But then Renee said she gravitated to the sweater because it's a symbol of hope, which is unusual for an artifact from the Holocaust.
"I like this sweater because it's a sweater that survived, as did its owner, and it's an act of love."
An act of love when Christina's grandmother knitted it for her in 1939. An act of love when Leah recreated it to keep Christina's memories alive. and an act of love when Renee will give it to her own granddaughter to teach her about survival. For The World, I'm Sarah Birnbaum.
The McLean brothers of Edinburgh, Scotland are aiming to set a world record, the fastest trio to ever row across the Atlantic. The Talisker Whiskey Atlantic Challenge is reputed as one of the most difficult tests of endurance on the planet. More people have been in space than have rowed the 3,000 miles from the Canary Islands to Antigua, but Lachlan, Ewan, and Jamie McLean say they are up for it. They've even got a team name, the Broar Brothers, as in bro and or. Yeah, go ahead, groan. Jamie McLean says they're doing well, now over halfway through their journey.
So the start of the race was actually some of the roughest conditions we've had so far. We were kind of thrown in at the deep end, a baptism of wind and waves. There were maybe 20-foot waves and 25 to 30-knot winds. We sort of went in somewhat naively and just embraced it, and that worked to our advantage. Morale is, yeah, surprisingly high.
He spoke on a satellite phone there. The world record bid requires the brothers to be on a strict schedule. Someone always needs to be rowing the high-tech boat. It's even tricked out with solar panels.
We're always strapped to the boat 24/7. We have approximately 4 hours sleep, and then the rest of the 24 hours is split up into two on, one off on the oars. Very, very little time to rest. You have to keep your wits about you at all times.
Jamie says he and his brothers have been astonished by how well they've been doing over the past 25 days.
Probably one of our greatest takings from it is how the human body can, when put in such adverse conditions, just adapt. The body just puts up with it and even manages to thrive.
The Broar brothers estimate it'll be another 12 days before they reach their goal, Antigua. And that is The World on this Tuesday from the Nan and Bill Harris studio at WGBH here in Boston. I'm Marco Werman. See you back here tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of WGBH Boston, the BBC World Service, and PRX.